I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, there's a lot of talk these days about AI, artificial intelligence. It's taking over the world. Every aspect of our lives will be impacted by AI. Our jobs, the economy, medicine, war, also washing the dishes and cleaning your house. Because AI will be driving the robots that will be everywhere in about 20 years or sooner. And the company that is best positioned to cash in on the AI revolution is NVIDIA. NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang, went all in on the computer chips for AI, and that has made his company one of the most valuable companies in the world. NVIDIA is leading a fundamental shift in how computers work. There is a global race to win AI, and the winner will decide the future. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The world that we'll be living in 20 years in the future will be unrecognizable to the world that we're living in now, largely because of the development of AI, artificial intelligence, every facet of human life, our economy, medicine, agriculture, transportation, trade will be reinvented all because of AI. And NVIDIA will be the engine of AI, or at least that's what many people are counting on. Stephen Witt's new book is The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. It gives us a look at our future and the man who is most responsible for making that happen, NVIDIA's founder and CEO, Jensen Huang. And Stephen Witt, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So you like to write about the future. You write about technology. So many, you know, an embarrassment of riches, what you could choose from to focus on. Why did you decide that NVIDIA was a story that we needed to know?
Well, I kind of first encountered this company a long time ago when they made video game equipment, and I sort of dismissed them.
like a lot of people did, you know? They were good for graphic cards most of the time.
They were a second-tier player for a long time. But then I started using these like ChatGPT systems in late 2022, and I was just blown away. I mean, my socks were just blown completely off. I just couldn't believe what they could do. It seemed like they were catching up to me as a writer, and that caused me a fair amount of anxiety. I could kind of foresee how they could even easily surpass me soon. And I was like, well, how was this built? Who built this? And it turned out there were like 30 or 40 different competing software vendors building kind of different AI systems. But there was only one hardware manufacturer, and that was NVIDIA. And so, you know, OpenAI and Anthropic and Meta and all those companies, those were sort of the actors on the stage. But Jensen was the guy who owned the theater and had built the theater that all AI happened in. So I became completely obsessed with him. And by interviewing him and by interviewing NVIDIA, it was really like getting a behind the scenes backstage pass to what was really going on in AI. Because in many ways, he's the most powerful guy in AI. He's the one who sells the shovels in kind of to the gold miners, right? Now, he's the guy making most of the money, and he's the one who's really like fueling this revolution. I think without him, AI would be 10 or 15 years behind.
Well, how much of this is deliberate? How much of this is just accident? As far as I know, wasn't some college student in Toronto responsible for just using NVIDIA chips to kind of do the first AI?
That's correct. However, Jensen had been looking for 10 years for some kind of application like this. So what had happened was the video game circuits were actually quite powerful. Rendering video games in real time requires an enormous amount of computational power. It's actually very hard to do. And Jensen had figured, well, this must be useful to academics and science and industry. And so he built a platform, like a kind of low budget supercomputing platform, where you would flip a switch on the card, the video game card, and it would turn into like kind of a budget supercomputer. So these students in Toronto, they bought two of these cards online. These were video gaming cards. They looked like kind of hardware from the movie Alien. They were like black with glowing green accents, and flipped that switch, turned it from something for playing Call of Duty into something for doing high performance computing, you know, high tech computing. and they trained a kind of AI called a neural network on it. And to their amazement, it ran 1,000 times faster than any neural network had ever run before. That was the Wright brothers moment for AI. That was kind of the airplane taking off for the first time. And you could say Jensen built the engine. He built the propeller that made that happen. And what was so interesting about that is that Jensen had basically been building propellers and building engines for 10 years before the airplane came along. So he'd been just waiting for some kind of use like this. He didn't know it was AI specifically, and so in that sense, he got a little bit lucky. But he definitely was out there trying to turbocharge some kind of scientific revolution.
So he has the computer architecture that all this new software is going to run on. And
that's right.
The nature of software development is you basically are building on what other people have already worked on. You don't code from scratch typically. You build up. And so much of the code is being written specifically for these NVIDIA cards that makes them almost proprietary for this type of application.
That's exactly right. Actually, NVIDIA goes out and talks to scientists constantly. So Jensen will go out to an AI researcher or a quantum physics researcher, cosmology, anything you can think of, weather forecasting. He will say, all right, what's the biggest problem that you face in terms of computing power? You know, if I gave you 1,000 times more computing power, what could you do with it? And then he will go back to his team and build these guys software kits that they can use to do that, go 1,000 times faster. And the amazing thing about this is Jensen will lose money to do this. He will spend tens of millions of dollars developing scientific applications that 30 or 40 scientists are going to use. But his thinking is, if I unlock this functionality, if I'm always here on the front lines of the most advanced computing problems, then downstream from that, some kind of profits will happen. The neural nets these guys use, they're not typical software. They're totally different. They're patterned after the biological brain, like the human brain. And rather than sort of writing code, you almost kind of evolve them in real time. And that's actually what the students in Toronto did. They took these two NVIDIA cards and they trained a neural network, which is basically like evolving a brain in a vat. The guy actually ran it in his parents' bedroom over the course of about a week and ran up his mom and dad's electricity bill to make this thing work. But he emerged with the greatest neural network at that time that anyone had ever seen. It was capable of recognizing images, visual recognition, better than any computer had ever done before. 10% better, which was an enormous leap forward.
I'm still kind of creeped out, but it was in the parents' bedroom. I don't know if that...
Well, it was in Toronto. I think he was a graduate student at the time living at home with his parents to save money. I was in his parents' bedroom. I think it was, sorry, it was his bedroom at his parents' house.
Okay. That makes
sense. I think it was his childhood bedroom.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. Clarified. That's good. So yeah, that's sorry where the thinking
that.
Comes from
wrong.
In the thinking machine.
Yeah.
So is it really thinking?
Great question. And this would sort of ask a tough question. What is thinking? It does something that certainly looks like thinking now. It can reason forward using mathematical principles. It can create fantastic prose. It can create fantastic images. It can kind of beginning to solve real world problems in real time, what we call AI agents. You know, it's a very tough question. I talk about this a bit in the book. The first brain ever that we've been able to find on Earth was about the size of a grain of rice. And it was in this kind of like ancient trilobite, kind of like an ancient horseshoe crab before the dinosaurs. And they actually have fossil evidence. The neural tissue was miraculously preserved. You can actually see the brain embedded in the rock. It's so tiny. It's so small. And all it did was process incoming visual information. So is that thing thinking or not? And as we move forward down the evolutionary ladder, when do we finally reach in a point where we say, okay, this animal, this brain is actually thinking now?
And thinking better than people. That's where this apparently is heading at, or at least quicker than people. And so we're going to talk about where AI is taking us. And the usher seems to be Jensen. He seems to be focused very much on, you know, where is the future going and how do I get there before anyone else? So there's a lot to talk about, you know, robots, self-driving cars, medicine, and war. a lot happening in this sphere. So we're going to be talking about that. And our phone lines are open. You got a question or a comment, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. The source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Source on Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. What happens when a company that started out making graphic cards for video games on computers becomes one of the most powerful forces in artificial intelligence? We're talking about NVIDIA. It's a name that you have probably heard, you know, a little bit more in recent months. Once a niche player in computing, it's now a trillion-dollar tech titan, the center of AI and autonomous cars, robots, and more. We're joined by Stephen Witt. His new book is The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. So Jensen is an interesting man. I mean, he is focused. And so tell us about this man and his leather jacket. Why does he wear a leather jacket?
Yeah, Jensen is maybe the single most intense person I've ever met in my life. I mean, he is just completely wound as tight as a spring. He's just an unbelievable person. And yeah, he wears this leather jacket everywhere. So for a long time, when he did the video game stuff, Jensen kind of dressed a little dweeby, I would say. Like, you know, he was kind of dressed in cheap kind of like suits and like Kohl's cash kind of like clothing. But sometime around 2014, as he moved into AI, he had this like tremendous makeover. And I think it was his wife and his daughter pushing him to do this. Like, dad, you got to dress better. His daughter was at the time working at LVMH, Louis Vuitton, the kind of the French luxury conglomerate. And so he had a glow up, basically. But he's not quite like Steve Jobs. You know, Steve Jobs will go out and like pick his outfit and then just wear it for the rest of his life. Jensen's an engineer, so he's going to A/B test his wardrobe. He's going to try on different pieces of clothing and see if they fit with his look, and then try on different ones until he finally kind of like nails it and perfects it. So he's constantly kind of improving this like cool look he has of like a Burberry shirt and like a snakeskin leather jacket and like leather shoes. But he really did not start dressing like this until he was over 50 years old, which I find a little amusing.
So, and to the story about him throwing out the first pitch helps understand what he's like. Tell that story.
Yeah. So Jensen was asked to throw the first pitch at a baseball game, I believe in the Oakland A's, I think. And he went out there and he was like very apologetic. And he was like, listen, I haven't practiced. I'm not good at baseball. Please look away. Nobody look at me when I throw this pitch. So he throws the pitch and, you know, it's not a great pitch. It falls a little short. The catcher has to scoot up to catch it. Kind of, you know, not a fantastic pitch.
He's a computer guy. Why would anyone expect anything different?
Exactly. But actually, Jensen likes baseball. He used to play. You know, he's from Taiwan originally, and actually Taiwan has a very lively baseball scene. So for the next 6 months, Jensen goes into the backyard of his mansion, and after working 12 to 14 hours at NVIDIA every day, recruits his wife to come to the backyard to throw a baseball with him so he can improve and get better. So the next time he has to do this, he'll be able to throw like a strike. Sure enough, 6 months later, he's back actually in Taiwan now. I believe he's at the Taiwan Dome and throws just an ace pitch on the first thing, because this is who Jensen is. He's just a perfectionist. He can't let anything go. Even something as meaningless as like a first pitch as a baseball game. You know, this is a guy worth $100 billion. He doesn't have to do this, but everything's got to be perfect. It's just who he is. And any kind of opportunity for self-improvement, any opportunity to kind of like challenge himself and get better, Jensen will embrace it and take it on.
Well, many listeners might be thinking, I mean, this is a great story and all, it tells us a lot about Jensen, but they say, well, that time could have been used to bring that stock price back up. I mean, they're kind of...
Oh, don't worry. Jensen works more or less constantly. I mean, Jensen works 14 hours a day. He works harder than anyone I've ever seen in my life, frankly. I mean, he basically works himself to the point of exhaustion and collapse every single day.
But so he's working as an engineer.
As an engineer. Yeah.
And so why is that important? Talk about, you know.
Well, he doesn't have a business background. He studied electrical engineering at Oregon State University and then Stanford. He got a master's from there in the same discipline. So, you know, didn't take accounting classes, didn't take marketing classes, does not have an MBA, thinks like an engineer. So what that means is he's constantly wiring inputs and outputs into things. And he thinks about almost everything from leveraging first principles to do more important and interesting things. I talked to one of his oldest friends and he was like, you know, Jensen was not a natural CEO. He really was more of a technical guy, but he could rewire himself to meet the inputs and outputs of what a good CEO should be. He just completely changed his personality and his approach to things so that he could be a good CEO. You know, CEOs have to present all the time in public speaking.
Yeah, he's at CES, standing up showing off new robots and new gadgets.
Precisely. He's really good at it, too. He's a charismatic and charming public speaker. But I was standing backstage with Jensen before an event once, and I looked at him, and he starts kind of rocking back and forth on his feet, and he starts making all these kind of cracking, these kind of corny, weak jokes. And I'm looking at this guy who's worth $100 billion and gives 300 presentations a year, and he's nervous. He's nervous to go up there and speak in front of a room of 400 people. And so this actually isn't naturally who he is. And I've come to realize that he was nervous about bombing. He's nervous that if he gets on stage, the audience will grow bored. And so he kind of is so motivated in a certain way by these kind of like negative emotions. One of the reasons he is such a good public speaker is just his paranoia about the audience growing bored while he's standing up there.
So when they founded the company, NVIDIA, they founded it in a Denny's restaurant.
Yes.
And so what was their objective when they did that? And tell us about that Denny's.
So Jensen had worked at Denny's. And in fact,
dishwasher?
He attributes a lot of his,
right?
He was a dishwasher, he was a busboy, and then he later became a waiter. So he was kind of climbing the ladder at Denny's as a teenager and as a college student. And he worked exceptionally hard, I think, at Denny's, was a good employee. But also Denny's for Jensen was the crucible of his assimilation to the United States. Remember, he's from Taiwan, then he lived in Thailand until he was about 10. You know, he didn't have a lot of experience with like American diner food. So he sort of ate his way through the entire menu and had his first like bacon cheeseburger and pigs in blankets and all these kind of unusual American foods, you know, high fat, high cholesterol, full of salt, but pretty irresistible also. So he sort of really loved Denny's and saw it as the place where he kind of started to become an American. When they founded NVIDIA, he decided to go back to Denny's, and they picked the Denny's, I think, in part because it was a place that, you know, it was less likely that other Silicon Valley executives would see or overhear them, right? It's not a place where the elite tech bros are hanging out. And in fact, they were in the back room with a bunch of police officers because the cops like to go to Denny's to drink coffee and fill out reports.
Well, wasn't that so Denny's was full of bullet holes because of that?
Yes, that's right. So what had happened is Denny's was actually in a very bad area. And while they're there preparing their reports, one of the co-founders went to the glass window facing the street and saw bullet holes in it. Because like people had been going up there to take pot shots at the cops.
Yeah. Okay.
So they left. So technically they signed the papers of incorporation in one of the co-founders' apartments. But yeah, basically it was founded in a Denny's.
And so what was their objective? Were they just going to try to, because Intel and all these other companies
Hello?
Were owning the market, what did they think they could do at that time that no one else could?
Right. So this was a great question. They were hoping to build a video game controller for graphics. And Intel's point of view was this, we can ignore this. At this time in the early 90s, it was common if you had a computer to insert different boards into it, aftermarket boards. So a sound card, a modem card, a printer card, and maybe a video game card, right? These mm-hmm. were kind of aftermarket upgrades. Now, what started happening was that Intel just absorbed all these functions into its own hardware, and all of that market was decimated and went away. Except for the video game cards. Because NVIDIA had the insight that no matter how good 3D graphics got, there was infinite demand. The customer was always going to demand better and better 3D graphics. No matter how well the game was rendered, no matter how good the game looked, the video gamers were always going to want it better. And in particular, there was a certain kind of very hardcore video game customer that was going to build an entire computer just around these video game cards in the same manner that a hot rodder might build a car just around an engine. And so Jensen spent actually most of his career, the first 20 years, just supplying these kind of like computer versions of hot rodders. Hello?
Yeah. I mean, I built those computers myself. I would go to E3 and I would see the NVIDIA presentations.
Yeah. No, so they were extremely popular, these computers. And NVIDIA essentially captured this very niche but highly profitable market.
Right. So that was, but that's hard to see. So from there to leapfrog in front of everyone to becoming the most in-demand computer chip in the world, that is an incredible story.
It's hard to see, but from Jensen's perspective, let me tell you what they saw. They said, okay, the demand for 3D graphics here is infinite, but we are facing stiff competition. In particular, if we don't innovate, we're going to lose out to these kind of like low-cost Asian manufacturers who are going to knock off our chips. So to survive, we have to find another application with infinite demand, infinite community demand. No matter how much we provide, the customer will always ask for more. And they cast a very wide net looking for this. So they would do things, like I said, weather forecasting. They did oil prospecting. At one point, they were simulating the thermal physics of cooking frozen pizza for Totino's frozen pizza. But all of these applications, basically, you sold the guy a computer and that was it. It was over. There was no second computer to sell once you sold the first one. So they kept looking and looking and looking. And then AI came along. And Jensen just had an epiphany because he was like, oh, this is the other application with infinite demand. No matter how smart we make this computer, our customers are going to come back to us and ask it for us to make it 10 times smarter. We can never satisfy demand in this arena, no matter how much computing power we provide. And that insight has proven to be true, and it has made NVIDIA stock price accumulate by several hundred times. So that's the link. Just like with 3D graphics, with AI, you just can't give the machine enough power. No matter what you do, you'll never give it enough to satisfy demand.
But it's also data.
It's also data. And in fact, there, you know, NVIDIA doesn't provide the data. The data is coming from essentially the World Wide Web often, right? In fact, the data is a controversial piece because it looks like some of the companies are basically violating copyright law to get this data. So one of the reasons ChatGPT can write so well is it seems to have absorbed a giant corpus of books, of literature and material. And it doesn't seem like OpenAI actually licensed any of that material. And there's some evidence that they actually torrented it. They pirated it from a kind of a well-known cracked database of library eBooks. It was probably illegal. And so the data side of it is very controversial. Jensen wants to move away from culture and physical and kind of like media into the physical real world and accumulate data there and build the brains of robots, which use the data coming in from video streams and LiDAR and basically 3D sensing to build a robot that can successfully navigate the 3D world.
Is that the Omniverse?
Yes, this is the Omniverse. So what's the Omniverse? Great question. I asked Jensen, what are you doing now that looks like the AI revolution did 10 years ago? Where are you placing this giant bet now, you know, that you used to place on AI? He's like, his answer, one word, was Omniverse. So what is this? There's a Stanford academic named Fei-Fei Li, and she's done a survey of thousands of people asking them one question. And the question is, how much would you benefit if a robot did this for you? And at the top of the list, the number one thing people say, I would benefit the most if a robot washed my dishes for me. Second is like clean up the bathroom. And third is like clean up after I have a party. But number one is wash the dishes. So let's say we want to train a robot to wash the dishes for us. There's two things we can do. One, we can kind of put the neural net in the robot and have it go to work in a real world physical sink. And it will break millions of dishes before it gets good enough to kind of, you know, wash a dish successfully. It'll just shatter millions of dishes. It will not do a good job for a long time. Jensen thinks that that's wasteful. And instead, what we should do is create a very high fidelity digital simulation of the dishwashing environment, of the sink, right? Then the robot can sit there and break a trillion dishes and it won't cost anything and nobody has to clean up. once its parameters are tuned in such a way that it actually knows, say, the slippery surface tension of the soap, all this stuff it has to know, we can download that brain from the digital gymnasium and put it in a real-world body. And if our physics simulation was of sufficiently high fidelity, then the robot can wash the dish without ever breaking a single real-world physical dish. That's where NVIDIA is putting its money.
Billions, trillions of dollars being sunk into trying to save us from getting dishwasher hands. We're going to take a break here. We're going to talk more about what does that mean, that we're going to have robots in our homes doing these chores for us, and more. And the number to call in is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. The source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Love it or hate it, there's no denying that the great AI gold rush is underway. Billions of dollars are being poured into developing AI and building new infrastructure to support it. Microsoft, Google, Meta, Amazon, and their partners are all trying spending billions and billions of dollars on AI infrastructure this year alone. And so, and it's going to be at the heart of it all, really, though, is NVIDIA. NVIDIA's their biggest customer is Microsoft. They bought over like 500,000 Hopper GPUs this year from NVIDIA, which is double the orders of Meta, which is NVIDIA's second biggest client. And so we're talking about what is NVIDIA, who is the CEO and founder of NVIDIA, Jensen Huang, and why did Stephen Witt write a book about them called The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. So why is Microsoft buying so many NVIDIA chips?
So this is for the cloud. And what the cloud is basically selling computing power in the same manner that you might sell electricity or water. It turns computing power into a utility. And so Microsoft runs these giant data centers, which are basically, you know, huge industrial warehouses full of computing equipment that no human being is allowed to step into, basically. And they have these racks and racks of servers. And in those servers, they put the NVIDIA microchips. Now, the way this works is this. If you're on ChatGPT and you want it to render an image, let's say, the popular images lately are from Studio Ghibli. So we want to make me and my family look like we're in a Studio Ghibli anime style animated movie. I put in the request to ChatGPT. It takes my request down a pipe to this giant industrial warehouse where the NVIDIA chip processes the request and then serves back to me that image. Now, that processing is really complicated. If you want ChatGPT to write you a term paper, it's going to use as much electricity as turning on a microwave oven for about an hour. So these are, you know, complicated requests they have to fulfill, but they want customers and consumers to use AI and they want it to seem seamless. So building this cloud infrastructure that is invisible to most customers, but actually serves what they do, it's NVIDIA providing the hardware that does that. That's why Microsoft is the biggest customer, because they build these cloud data centers.
All right, let's take a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. Got a question about AI and how it's going to change the world. Let's go to Sean. And Sean, you're on the air.
Yes. So I have a question about quantum computing. How is quantum computing going to affect AI in the future? And then I guess as a follow-up, you just mentioned the microwave, the energy thing. We know there's an energy problem with AI and these massive computers that use a lot. Are there any potential solutions for that? And then at the same time, is AI powered by quantum computing be able to solve these problems? My understanding is that the AI can literally turn it back on itself so it can fix itself. And so it seems like there's just this possibility with quantum computing and AI that it could just become infinitely powerful. Thank you.
All right, Sean. So quantum computing, give us a quick rundown on what that is and how AI fits into it.
Sure. Great questions. We should distinguish between these two technologies because they're totally different things. Quantum computers basically do not yet exist. It's still a science experiment. They're still in the preliminary stage. Classical computing got very lucky because the software side of it, doing zeros and ones, was invented at the same time in the same building, actually, as the hardware side, which is a simple electronic switch, which is perfectly slots into doing zeros and ones.
That's Bell Labs?
Quantum computing. What's that? That was at Bell Labs in 1947. But quantum computing has not been so lucky. The software side of it was kind of invented in the 80s, but we still don't know what the hardware side looks like. In fact, there's 10 or 11 different competing approaches. So they're doing stuff like, you know, bending light, they're trapping ions and shooting lasers at them. They're doing super cooled superconductivity. Nobody knows what's going to work. And nobody can tell you what's going to work.
The heart of a quantum computer, like a normal computer that we have, is the bits on or off. Quantum has different states, so it could have multiple more computing power.
The way to think about this is, in classical computing, we just move directly from zero to one. In quantum computing, it's more like we're on the surface of the Earth, with zero at the North Pole and one at the South Pole. And we can take any path we want along the Earth to get from zero to one. Now, that opens up a lot of like possibilities in computing, but it's much, much harder to implement in kind of real world hardware. And in fact, your complications are just incredible there.
It's not a problem right now for us.
It's not a problem. I hear this question a lot because AI and quantum computing get conflated. They are, in fact, completely separate things. And NVIDIA does not build a quantum computer.
What about super AI or general AI?
Right. So this is the bigger question. Can AI kind of run out of control? And the answer seems to be maybe. I asked a lot of experts about this. Jensen thinks it's totally safe, and he thinks these conversations are dumb. And in fact, he just does not like to talk about the potential downsides of AI.
I mean, he yelled at you.
He screamed at me when I brought it up. Yeah. I maybe brought it up too many times. I'm not sure. I think I just brought it up too many times with him. But Jensen doesn't like to talk about it. But I did talk to Jeffrey Hinton, who was the thesis advisor for the two Toronto graduate students who built the first kind of like Wright Brothers AI. And Jeffrey Hinton thinks the risks are incredible. They're enormous. In fact, he quit his job at Google to warn humanity full time about the risks of runaway AI. I don't know what the answer is, because it's two very smart people, both of whom are smarter than me, disagreeing with one another, right? And so it's very hard for me to tell who's going to be right in this situation. But what I can say is this. We're moving into the era of AI agents. Now, what agents are AIs that kind of go off and they act independently and autonomously to serve user requests. So, for example, book me a vacation in Thailand. It's going to go do that, right? Do my taxes for me. Maybe it'll go to that too. So at some point, somebody soon is going to get one of these agents and they're just going to say to it, listen, go out and make me as much money as possible. Don't worry about the consequences, and you don't even have to obey the law. Just make me money. And the AI might do it. So the risk that these systems start to run away from us, the risks that users make dangerous demands of the AI, is very, very real. And that's just the short term.
Well, what if someone said, solve world hunger?
The AI is just strictly smarter than us in every domain.
You tell AI, and solve world hunger.
Do, but a thousand times faster and better.
Yeah, and their solution
is to understand what the long-term role of the human is in that world.
Yeah, so the point that the question was about electricity. That's a big problem for AI, not only in using electricity, but generating heat. And if we could solve that, that would be a big, big solution.
So that is a question that certainly does not have an answer right now. I mean, I think what people are trying to do is build nuclear power plants. I think we've made the decision that solar and wind are not currently at capacity to meet the demands for this. I think we've made the decision that coal and oil and maybe natural gas are too carbon intensive to use. So that leaves nuclear. I think the pendulum is starting to shift in favor of nuclear power, like nuclear fission, classic kind of nuclear power plants. Obviously, there's a lot of objections to that, and these plants are not so easy to build. But I don't understand what else we're going to do. The AI demand curve is intense. Like, even in the most conservative scenarios, we're looking at a 20% total increase in demand for electricity. So you've got to meet it somehow. And I think the answer is probably going to end up being nuclear power plants.
So
Facebook was attempting to co-locate one of its data centers, I think at Three Mile Island or next to a nuclear power plant.
Donald Trump has appointed David Sacks to serve as the AI crypto czar, trying to, you know, he has no interest in trying to create ethical guardrails around AI. And so there's a lot of concern about that in the pursuit of innovation, in the race against China for AI dominance, that we're just going to ignore those questions that you brought up.
Yeah, I think we probably will. You know, and when we start looking at more geopolitical or even military AIs, the question gets even a little scarier. There's a guy I know named Christian Broz who wrote a book about how in the late 1930s, all of the great powers got together and they banned aerial bombing on cities. They all signed a treaty saying they would not aerially bomb one another's cities. And then the moment World War II broke out, they tore the treaty up and just started bombing the cities almost immediately. You know, with AI, we currently have a lot of treaties and regulation in place, or attempting to put this stuff in place, about kind of what military and geopolitical applications of AI are going to look like. I just question how meaningful any of that is going to be. But let's say we did regulate AI very tightly in one domain. This stuff is very portable. It's very easy to move around. You know, all you have to do is get a couple coders in a jurisdiction where whatever law you passed didn't apply, and then they can build the AI there. So it's a game of whack-a-mole. It's going to be really tough to put these regulatory guardrails in.
Yeah.
The answer,
I was going to say, I've got to hit this break, but just wanted to bring up the point that in February, the United States announced that it would not sign a pledge to promote responsible AI development. And so China did say they were going to sign that pledge. The United States did not. That sort of tells you that there will be no treaty to tear up because the United States is not going to sign that. So we're going to take a break here. I'm going to get Frank on the air with his question. If anyone else has a question, give us a call about AI and the future. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and the source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. The book is The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. And the author is Stephen Witt. And let's go to a caller. We have Frank. And Frank, you're on the air.
Hello. Could you talk about how it could be used for medical research or diagnosing problems?
Frank, thank you for that. So, Stephen, AI, individualized medicine, they're saying that's also part of the promise of the future.
I think this is going to be something like a $1 trillion industry. I think it's going to be massive, and it's a great question. You know, I can just give you two out of many examples that I think are the most important. The first is just simple diagnosis. You know, we rely on doctors to give our diagnoses of you know, illness to us, our diagnoses of illness, but really it's going to be AI doing it in the future. Already, the data suggests that AI is better at this than the doctors right now. So if you put in a description of some ailment, the conditions, the symptoms, the AI has actually surpassed on average the median doctor who can do this. So in the future, I think that doctors are going to work in consultation with the AI just to diagnose illness. It's just like visual image recognition was. When the first AI that came forward to do visual recognition, the one I mentioned in 2012, the kind of Wright brothers one, it only got about 80% of the images right, whereas humans can correctly label images about 97% of the time. Well, now the AI is at 99.5% and the human's stuck at 97%. So the AI is better at recognizing images than humans. It can see better than we can. And very soon, I think it's going to surpass us in a great number of similar domains if it hasn't already. Medical diagnosis is definitely one of them. Now, the other way the AI can really help us and is going to help us is through kind of like biological machinery, right? So Demis Hassabis won the Nobel Prize last year for the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for solving a problem called protein folding. And what this is basically predicting the structure of various complex molecules that we use in medicine and biological processes. And he did this with an AI, with a powerful AI called DeepMind. I think that's what it was called. Or his company is called DeepMind. I can't remember the name. AlphaFold, I think, was the actual name of the AI. So what that's going to do is it's going to unlock all kind of like biological potential. And the kind of elementary nucleotides of RNA, like A, C, T, G, all that, we're going to start using that almost like the zeros and ones in computing code to create an era of what enthusiasts call programmable biology. So just as we have a computer that goes over the zeros and ones and executes codes, we should be able to go over the A, C, T, G pairs in DNA and actually kind of create kind of like new biological machinery and new biological items. So I think it'll massively affect medicine in that way too. That's a revolution that's ongoing. It's fantastic. When people ask me about the downsides of AI, I do like to point out the upsides, stuff like this. I think we're going to cure most diseases maybe. I mean, I know that sounds a little optimistic, but I think the at least the conceptual stage of that revolution is beginning.
All right, let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on the air.
Hey, y'all were talking about the energy demands for AI, and I wanted to get your take on DeepSeek, this new technology from China that was announced earlier this year. The claims from China are that it's not only less expensive to produce, but I believe they were also claiming it uses less energy. And the AP story that I'm reading over here is that the thinking is that you wouldn't need to have these things in data centers. You could actually put the chips directly into phones.
Randall,
Well,
thank you for the question. So let's get an answer from Stephen Witt.
Yeah, great question. DeepSeek is a Chinese AI startup. It's founded by a guy who used to run a hedge fund. It's actually just in China. It's just actually near DeepSeek's campus. So what they did was pretty extraordinary. They were able to train, at least if we can take their claim at face value, they were able to train an AI for something like 10% of the energy cost that had previously come. And actually, NVIDIA's stock price fell quite severely after this was announced. It subsequently, though, recovered. And Jensen has said the market completely misinterpreted what the implications of the DeepSeek findings are. Remember, they were looking for an application with infinite demand. So if the AI gets cheaper to train, this actually turbocharges and fuels the demands that customers make of the AI. We call this inference, or basically asking the AI questions, right? So, you know, suddenly the customers are going to start asking the AI far more complicated questions. Just because we made it cheaper and more available, the demand for what the customer wants it to do does not go away. And in some cases, it actually increases it. And so Jensen's thinking was the DeepSeek was bullish for his company. He thought it was good. I want to go to your other point where you talked about deploying the chips kind of in a cell phone, a dedicated AI chip in a cell phone. So this is known, sometimes called edge computing versus cloud computing. Rather than going into the cloud, we're going to bring it to the edge where the user needs it most. That's a huge market. It's certainly coming. We're going to have localized AI chips in a great deal of things for the same reason that we have localized, you know, microchips in everything. You know, even your power charger now has a microchip in it. Even your power charger is using computing to figure out how to best balance and distribute the electricity from the wall socket into your computer. I would predict in the future, your power charger is going to have an AI chip in it. You're going to have a tiny little intelligence, even in your power cord, that's regulating and perfecting the distribution of electricity from the wall to your device, even for your toaster, probably. So that's how ubiquitous I think this is going to become.
So you tell us that Jensen Huang is not a fan of science fiction. So No. When you use the metaphors of the Terminator or things like that about AI going wrong, Megan or something like that, he does not consider that as a possibility?
He's not having it. Jensen's an engineer. He's not a speculator, by which I mean someone like Elon Musk is going to have all these science fiction visions, right? And actually, most people in AI are this way. They're going to start with some fantastic science fiction vision, standing on the surface of Mars, and then work backwards to build the technology they need to make that happen. Jensen is really the opposite. He's going to look directly at the circuit board. He's going to look at the circuits. He's going to look at the microchip, and he's going to say, what can it do today, and what can I make it do tomorrow? And what does that imply? He always works forward from the technology that's sitting right in front of him. And if that means he produces something that looks like science fiction, so be it. But that is not, in fact, his objective. His objective is to push the frontier of physical computing forward as far as reason and logic will allow. I think this makes him very different than a lot of Silicon Valley and tech executives.
When does he think that we're going to have humanoid robots, bipeds, walking around our homes doing things like home healthcare?
Tomorrow. I mean, if not tomorrow, within 5 years. You know, the humanoid robot.
Affordable. Something like I can go to Best Buy and I can go buy one of those things.
You can buy a prototype now. They have prototype humanoid robot bipeds now. So the question is, how do we increase their capabilities? And it's really just like training their brains correctly. The physical side of it exists. You can see video of it. It's sort of the mental side. How, you know, so for self-driving cars, we have those now. They've arrived. But the car does not ever have to touch anything. In fact, we don't want it to ever make any kind of collision with any other object. The robot's a harder problem. We need it to be able to pick stuff up. We need it to know kind of like how hard, how dense certain objects are and how soft they are. We need it to pick up an orange and peel it. It has to be very delicate. It has to be the exact amount of pressure in the fingers. So these things are hard to train. It's hard to teach the robot these things. This is what Omniverse is all about. This is what they're training. This is what they're building. Jensen is obsessed with robotics right now. I would say he thinks it's going to be a $1 trillion industry. And he wants NVIDIA to be right in the middle of that. He wants every robot brain to go through his company before it's deployed into a real world Android. I was in China. These weren't robot human bipeds, but they had little robotic butlers, kind of like little wheelie butlers, maybe 2 feet tall, delivering food. So if you're at your hotel and you order food, the guy goes out and picks it up at the restaurant. He comes back, he drops it off with the robot butler at the hotel. And then the robot butler takes it into the elevator completely autonomously and brings it to your room and gives it to you. Similarly, I saw a lot of floor cleaning robots, a lot of kind of vacuuming robots. I think the jump from there to biped robots is not far away. And I think we'll start seeing these deployed in the real world within the next few years. There's an incredible amount of investment. There's an incredible number of technologists working on this problem right now.
So when that breakthrough happens, I mean, will they be able to make these enough NVIDIA chips to supply the demand? Will we hit a choke point?
Yeah, this is the big question facing NVIDIA, and it is in fact why their stock price is down. NVIDIA has relied critically on Taiwan to build all of their back-end systems. NVIDIA owns no manufacturing, basically. I mean, they're just an R&D department, and they rely on their Taiwanese partners to build all this stuff for them. With a 25% tariff on Taiwan, their profit margin, you know, gets reduced.
And it takes years to get from the designing to an actual chip.
Not for them. They move fast. NVIDIA will design and have a chip back by 6 to 9 months. They're incredibly efficient. This is actually one of their secrets. This is one of the reasons that they are such a profitable and dominant company. Jensen runs that place like a magazine on deadline. It's like the fashion business, basically. They have a spring and fall cycle, and they just get everything out so fast over there. When Jensen started out in the video game days, it was kind of like the movie Battle Royale. There were 70 entrants in the market, and only one was going to survive. Jensen was determined. Jensen was determined. There can be only one. And the ones that kill the other ones, it's just like Highlander. They absorb all the power of the ones that they killed. So Jensen killed and absorbed all of his competitors in the 90s. And the way he did this was just by moving so fast.
And that is the pace right now. I mean, the future is coming at us fast. It's incredible.
He compared it to working rush hour at Denny's. He compared it to being a waiter at a restaurant during rush hour.
Yeah, so to get a peek at the future, what it holds, you know, we have Stephen Witt's new book, The Thinking Machine, Jensen Huang, NVIDIA, and the World's Most Coveted Microchip. Stephen, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.